Yeah, this is a big one.
This is kind of big. This is big for me because we haven't recorded like face to face in like 2 months. And
Yeah, it's been a minute for
so
us.
we've done some minisodes like
We were
over
delayed,
phone.
and whose fault was it?
Mine.
No, it was mine, because I went on holiday.
Oh, that's right. You went on
I went
vacation.
on holiday.
Well, I've been very busy at work too, so that's
That's
kind of
true.
put
You
a.
were out of town for work for a
I was
while.
out of town for a week, and then I had like a week to catch up on stuff at work, and then it's just been crazy. It's been a crazy month.
But we're back.
The Popstorian Podcast with Chris and Ben.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market.
A date which will live in infamy.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Might have gotten away with it, too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The evil of the thriller.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
Great power comes great responsibility.
We are back. We are officially back.
Yes.
For a long-form, regular old episode. Not a mini-sode.
And of a great movie.
And it's a great movie. It's a big, important movie. I am very intimidated by this material.
Actually.
Because it's our first John Ford.
It is John Ford.
Who's arguably the greatest Western director of all time. And definitely the most associated with the genre.
Yeah.
Of any.
Yeah, I would say you're right about that. But he's definitely associated with the Western genre, and we have to talk about him.
Yeah.
And
so we had to cross that bridge at some point.
Westerns by the Decade.
So Ben, I'm going to tell you, you probably are going to do more of the talking this time around. I figure I'm going to tell you that after we start rolling so that you can be less nervous when
Great.
I tell you
Wonderful.
That. Like last time we recorded Destry Rides Again.
Yes.
You told me how awesome my research was and how much research we put into it.
Yes.
I didn't put that much research into this one. As much research into this one.
Yeah, I didn't either, strangely.
So I'm going to let you talk about the film a lot more than me.
It's an overwhelming piece of work, partially because of John Ford, but also because of Wyatt Earp.
Yeah.
Who's such a huge figure in American history, just because of the pure legend.
So I didn't actually read any full biographies of Wyatt Earp, but I did read pieces of Casey Teffertiller, Wyatt Earp, The Life Behind the Legend. I'm pretty sure I slaughtered his name. This is probably one of the best regarded biographies of Wyatt Earp that I've come across. It's been highly recommended a number of times.
Gotcha.
I actually got this book when I was taking a Gilded Age class in college, although we didn't actually use this book in school. But it's actually highly recommended. And then I also read parts of another biography, which was dealing more with the legend rather than the actual man himself. And after reading those and then reading Wikipedia and a lot of other articles, I'm still not entirely certain where legend ends and where legend begins.
Yeah, so I found a few sources about Wyatt Earp, and they all quite authoritatively say very different things.
So in the last chapter of Teffertiller's book, he talks about there was a number of biographies and memoirs coming out when actually this film and, of course, Stuart Endlich's book, Frontier Marshal, which happens, was that 31, I think that comes out?
Thereabouts.
And then, of course, the movies that followed that, including My Darling Clementine, 1946, and then later on, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Doc, and a lot of these other
films. Slew of others.
And especially in the early 90s with Tombstone and Wyatt Earp. The just like a number of books just keep coming out whenever these movies hit the screens, and it's just Mythbusters come out. But anyway, he's these books kept coming out, and so there's two very distinctive sides to this story. There's the old timers who were kind of on the Clanton side, and it's more the shopkeepers who are on the kind of the Wyatt Earp side. And apparently, from what I've read or what I've managed to piece together, is that this debate stems all the way back to the Civil War, when you had Confederate sympathizers versus Union sympathizers. And in the Gilded Age, the late early Gilded Age, set in like the 1870s, 1880s, is when the gunfight actually takes place in the 1880s.
Yeah, I think 1881.
I think you're right. That's still kind of part of the feud that's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Earps are U.S. Marshals, which represent kind of this federal government. And the Clantons are kind of the ranchers that have been there forever and kind of like this rebel ideology
creeping
out.
Yeah, so let's, before we get too deep into
the mythology
and the history of it, let's back up and talk about the movie for a second.
Yeah.
I'll attempt to synopsize it,
as I often do.
So this film starts out in very iconic fashion with the Earp family, the Earp brothers. They start off driving cattle across
Arizona.
And they're headed to sell their cattle and make their fortune. So they're cattlemen, basically, at the beginning of the story. And they run into the Clantons, go into the town of Tombstone for supplies, leaving the youngest Earp on guard. And he's actually killed, they believe, by the Clantons. So they decide to stick around in this town of Tombstone, kind of feel out what's going on and try to see what they can do to bring some law and order in. It's a very rough and tumble town, Tombstone.
In the film, yeah.
In the film. It's depicted similarly to, although with less comedic intent, to the town in our last movie, Destry.
Right.
Rise Again.
Good comparison. Yeah.
What was the name of that town?
Bottleneck, I think.
Bottleneck, you're correct.
Yeah.
In the film.
Uh-huh.
So Earp decides to take on the role of Marshall.
Town Marshall. Yeah.
And discovers that the town is very much being run by...
by Victor Mature's Doc Holliday.
Yes.
And they actually meet in a saloon. It's kind of funny. It's Wyatt Earp, played by Henry Fonda, is playing poker and is trying to keep one of the lady characters, Linda Darnell's character, is it Chihuahua?
What's her Chihuahua, name? Yes.
From cheating. And so he takes a break from his game and takes her out, dunks her in a water trough. And she along with many others, are saying, just wait till Doc comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he gets back to his game, and Doc Holliday walks in. And he has a confrontation with a greenhorn. I don't think they actually mention him by name, but he's a barely cheater, and he's been kicked out of the town by Doc Holliday. And Wyatt Earp comes by and says, you know, that's my job. Because he's the town marshal.
He's the marshal now.
And
he basically comes in a cowpoke off the range and assumes the mantle of responsibility because nobody else will.
And so this creates kind of a tension between Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp. Mm-hmm. So here's the U.S. Marshal versus the town boss. And it ends peaceably. Because it's a great scene, actually. They're sitting at the corner of the bar. Doc Holliday is sitting there drinking champagne, if I recall.
Yeah, he orders champagne for Earp, even though Earp wants whiskey.
And Wyatt Earp says no whiskey, and they have this little bit of showdown here.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, we'll shoot it out. And Wyatt Earp says, I don't have a gun. And Victor Mature's character, or Doc
Another
Holliday,
throwback to Destry there.
Yeah, and he goes back, he's like, get this man a gun, we can get this man a gun. And suddenly a gun slides across the bar, and Wyatt Earp grabs it, and he's like, this is a nice gun. Feels like Brother Morgan's? I think it's Brother Morgan's gun.
Uh-huh.
Who's played by the very awesome Ward Bond.
Yes, Ward Bond.
And he's like, That's Brother Morgan right there. And that's Brother Virgil. And his two brothers are sitting next to Doc Holliday. And he realizes he's outgunned.
Yeah. Outnumbered and outmanned.
So there's a moment of tension, and then laughter, I believe, is broken mm-hmm. it. And they become fast friends at this point.
Yeah. So the story kind of veers off and follows a little bit of Doc Holliday's character, who's... very interesting person, educated from the East, and now he's got tuberculosis, obviously struggling with that, and alcoholism as well. And the titular character, my darling Clementine, arrives about halfway through the film. She comes in on the stage looking for Doc.
She's played by Kathy Downs.
She's there to try and bring him back to his life back East that he's been running from. I guess you could say that he kind of rejects her.
Yeah, he rejects her. And this seems to confuse Wyatt Earp, who's immediately drawn to her.
Mm-hmm.
Very much becomes the love interest of Wyatt Earp's character, the Wyatt character Wyatt Earp in this film.
Which is a very well-played relationship, I think, the way that that happens. Because Earp is played by Fonda very much as a... very subtly. It's a very subtle performance, I think.
It kind of reminds you of another film he did with Ford, going back to Young Mr. Lincoln,
mm-hmm.
which was done in 1939 also.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of brings that to the Wyatt Earp, that legend to Wyatt Earp in this film.
The mild-manneredness.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Definitely comes into play. So that plot sort of develops, and along the way, the Clantons... are still
around, still plotting
and being devious, and things are coming to a head there,
yeah,
slowly but surely. And then Doc leaves town, and Earp believes that Doc was the one who was responsible for killing his younger brother, because Chihuahua has his younger brother's necklace.
Yeah, it's a plot point earlier on in the film that you're shown this cross that he's buying for his fiance,
right?
And then it just turns up missing after
him being
killed.
The youngest Earp brother,
right? And
Jim, did they call him
James Earp? Which
none of this is historically.
It's not historically accurate. He was not the youngest brother. I'm really trying not to go all Mythbusters and
on this,
and trying to like that's not historically accurate. This is, it's really hard.
It's hard not to.
It's really hard not to. And that's interesting because with everything I've read about this film, they talk about how inaccurate it actually is.
Uh-huh.
I think the main reason they do that is because John Ford actually came out and said that gunfight at the OK Corral is how it really happened, because I talked to Wyatt Earp.
Yeah, John Ford and Wyatt Earp actually did meet when Earp was kind of hanging around the Hollywood studios in the silent days.
Apparently, Wyatt Earp met a lot of guys, a lot of people.
Yes.
Him and Tom Mix, I gotta say Tom Mix again, because uh-huh. we've talked about him in the last three episodes.
Yes, we have.
Hart, H.S. Hart, which uh-huh. we talked about in Hell's Hinges.
Yep.
They both apparently were at his funeral, and from what I've read, pallbearers there.
Yeah. So Earp was very much involved in the enshrinement of his own legacy.
He certainly gave it a shot. He gave it a really good try. He tried people to make his story known. And there was, I think even at that time, there were people who were against kind of like villainizing him, vilifying
mm-hmm.
him. And he was still trying to get his story and his side of things out there.
Yes, and he chose the route of mass media, which proved to be a good decision.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a very good self-promoter from the stories I've heard. Is
mm-hmm.
that he had his good friend try to write a memoir for him,
mm-hmm.
and he did a terrible job. It was more onomatopoeias than
yeah.
actual story.
Yeah.
And that he missed out. He actually didn't really talk to Lake that much about his life. I think they
right.
had a few letters back and forth. But the book comes out in 1931, and Wyatt Earp dies in 1929.
Yes, which is what this movie is ostensibly based on, is
right.
the Stuart Lake
along
book.
With three previous movies, apparently. But anyway, the bit...
yes, so Chihuahua, who's Linda Darnell's character, who had
The cross.
Wyatt
Earp finds
it. Turns out... when Wyatt Earp tracks down Doc Holliday and confronts him about this necklace that Doc did not give it to her. She was going behind Doc's back and seeing one of the Clantons.
Right.
And so it was with the Clantons who stole the necklace and killed the youngest Earp.
And at this point, Billy Clanton, who I think is the young man that she's having the affair with, shoots Chihuahua when she like tells him who it is.
Yes.
And then runs off on horseback back to the Clanton ranch.
Which I don't understand why he didn't just shoot Wyatt.
Or Doc Holliday, for that matter.
Or Doc Holliday.
Yeah.
If you had to shoot somebody...
You want to shoot one of the guys with the guns, right?
It would make
especially
sense.
After Chihuahua's already outed you.
But there's this movie thing where you shoot somebody who's about to give information to somebody you don't want them to give information to, rather than just shooting the person that you don't want them to give information to.
Fair enough.
Don't know why? Drama.
So he's running off to the ranch, and Virgil rides in just at that time, and Wyatt yells at Virgil, his brother, Virgil. Get him, or chase him down. And he chases him down to the Clanton Ranch, which brings me to my favorite scene in this whole movie, actually. Right here.
Oh.
This is it. So...
This is the moment.
This is the moment. This is the chase
you've all been waiting for.
Of course it is. Yeah. Everybody cares about what I think. haven't we been doing this long enough to know that? Virgil chases
him down. I mean,
that's
what I tune in for.
Exactly, yeah. I listen to this podcast so I can hear myself talk about my opinion.
You don't listen to this podcast.
Actually, I do. but that's another story. I'll tell you about it later. Anyway, so Virgil shoots and hits Billy.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy makes it back to the ranch, but then like dies at the doorstep of his family ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring him in and they lay him on the bed. Well, Virgil rides in soon after this and knocks on the door. And he's like, I'm looking for Billy.
Mm-hmm.
And they let him in. And you can kind of see the sinisterness on Ike's face. This is Ike Clanton's character. I forget the actor who plays him. He does a lot of character work. He does a lot of character actors.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he lets him in, kind of sees that sinister look on his face, but he invites him into the bedroom where Billy... Yeah, that's him. Grant Withers. Grant Withers plays Ike. And Virgil sees him on the bed, and you see the old man, Clanton, who's played by the very great Walter Brennan.
Yes.
And he's like, there's Billy. And Virgil looks at him and says that, I'm sorry it had to come to this. Now, up to this point, you know what's going to happen. You know Virgil just walked into the lion's den and he's going to die. But you don't see it happen. You don't really see it how it's going to happen. He turns around and John Ford he positioned the camera here.
Mm-hmm.
So that you see Virgil coming out of the doorway and you see no one behind him.
Yeah.
And as soon as he clears the doorway, you hear this gunshot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's down. And his smoke clears and there is Walter Brennan with a Winchester.
Mm-hmm.
Just shot him in the back. And
it was a shotgun, wasn't it?
It was a shotgun? I thought it was a long gun. But either way, he shoots him in the back. And you saw it coming. You know he's going to die because the sinister look from Wither Grant. Grant Withers, excuse me. But... It just happens like in a second. You don't knock the kind of fake, funny, dying scene that you normally see.
It's very sinister and very...
It holds up even today. Like, Westerns that I've seen and action films that I've seen, death scenes.
Yeah.
It hits so hard.
It does, yeah.
It hit really hard.
It doesn't feel... A lot of times, violence in Westerns, especially from the heyday of the Western, feel very...
Very emotional.
A lot of the B-Westerns and such, the death scenes feel very glossed over.
Right.
The violence is very bloodless, and they fall off their horse and they're dead. And
yeah.
It's very, like, kids playing cowboys and Indians. This is a very grim and serious... This is a death scene from someone who's been through a war. And, of course, John Ford just gets back from World War II before making this.
And what's interesting about this is that you don't even get to know Tim Holtz, Virgil, Wyatt, Earp very much.
Mm-hmm.
He's just kind of there in the story.
You don't have a lot of emotional investment.
They tell him to do this and do that, which is kind of funny because historically he was actually the marshal.
Right.
He was like the head guy.
Yeah.
But he's like one of the younger brothers in this film, and they kind of send him to do this and that. You don't really get the chance to meet him very much.
Right.
Even though Holt was kind of an up and comer at this time, from my understanding. But he dies, and that just happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite scene in the film.
It's very gritty.
It's a very gritty film.
And it ties into one of the great scenes in the film earlier where they had pulled some guns on Earp. The Clintons tried to.
Yeah.
In a bar scene, and he basically defeats them without injuring them in a very handy gunfighter kind of way.
Yeah.
And Pa Clinton says, if you're gonna pull a gun, kill a man.
Yeah.
Basically. Like, yeah. If you go for your gun, finish the job.
Yeah.
And it's a great piece of characterization from Brennan, to where he's got his son dying on the bed.
Yeah.
And he's got his gun in his lap. And then he quickly and suddenly and ruthlessly just takes his vengeance.
And you know he's a bad guy in the classic sense.
He is.
Even in that part, he's shooting this guy in the back. You kind of feel for him because you know he just saw his son die in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, and he blames this family.
Yeah.
So it's really.
I love what Brennan does in that moment.
Yeah.
And in this film in general.
And it's like he almost doesn't even move in that scene.
You just see
the smoke coming from the gun.
Yeah. It's very minimalistic. And he doesn't have a whole lot to do in this movie, I feel like, Walter Brennan. He's definitely underused. And there's, in a lot of ways, it gets distracted by sidelines. Kind of, there's an actor who comes to town. And the actor recites scenes from
Hamlet.
From Hamlet.
Yeah.
And Doc Holliday knows Hamlet. And he quotes some of it with the actor. Helps the actor, who's kind of a drunk, remember his lines.
I do feel like that this film has a beginning and has, of course, the very climactic ending, mm-hmm. the gunfight, which we're going to eventually get to. In the middle, there's a lot of these vignettes.
Yes.
And there's just not a whole lot as a streamlined storyline going on here. Maybe that's me, and I'm not that good of a critic, but that was just what I was thinking about.
I feel like it's kind of, it's like there's all these rivers up on the top of a mountain. And they're all flowing downhill, and eventually they converge
mm-hmm.
into one plot line.
I can see that. Yeah,
I can kind of see that.
Okay.
But there's a central thread that starts, which is the Earps versus the Clintons and the showdown.
Yeah.
And that kind of is what all the other tributaries flow into.
Yeah.
Throughout. But yeah, so.
And then after this,
Virgil Earp has been killed.
He's been killed. The Clantons come into town, they drop Virgil's body out in the middle of the street, and Walter Brennan, is he dad? Pop? What do they call him?
I've been calling him Pa.
Pa Clinton. I forget what the actual character is. Old Man Clinton or something like that?
Yeah.
And he's like, we'll be waiting for you at the OK Corral. And so they run.
I think he even says the time, too, doesn't he?
I think. Meet us there at dawn or something. And, Wyatt Earp, of course, goes with his brother Morgan, and they start waiting it out. And during this is going on, by the way, we were just coming out of surgery. Chihuahua did go into surgery. Doc Holliday plays the surgeon, apparently trained back east to take care of this. And mm-hmm. Clementine as his nurse.
Yes.
So kind of bringing those characters back into
kind
it.
Kind of interesting to mention to their relationship.
Also, I gotta say this. Doc Holliday was not a surgeon. He was a dentist. So unless it was dental surgery. I'm done. No more Mythbusters, I promise. Anyway, they meet in this little room. Morgan and Wyatt are waiting for dawn to happen. They're preparing. Mm-hmm. And these two guys basically hired them for the town marshals come in, and they're going to help them out. But I'm a little confused on that part. Did they, like, say, no, don't help us out?
Yeah.
Your family guys, you're not going to know what to do?
They said, basically, this is our fight, and we're not going to involve you. Because they're basically trying to make Tombstone a decent place to live, townspeople are. They're building a church, and they're doing all this stuff to kind of make it livable.
And I feel like that aspect of that theme of the film is actually quite historically accurate.
Yes.
You have the townspeople trying to make this something, and then you have the ranchers on the outskirts.
Yeah.
And that's pretty classic in Western lore as well. So anyway, Chihuahua dies. Spoiler alert, I'm sorry. Doc Holliday comes.
If you've listened to this podcast for any time, you should know that.
See the movie first.
Always watch the movie first.
We watch the movie first. And Doc Holliday comes in, and they're like, how's Chihuahua? Or what happened? And he looks at it, and she's like, she's dead. And just like, plainly. And they're like, okay, you're in. You can come join us.
It's a very interesting development, too, because she's very much in love with him, but the feelings aren't really reciprocated.
So I feel like Doc here just feel like he let her down, and just kind of like, it's his fault.
He's kind of lost on an ocean of self-pity.
He really is.
Love with anybody.
He sends Clementine back east because he's like, I'm sick, I'm a killer now, don't see me like this. And then Chihuahua, who's like this worldly woman from the western town, knows what he is, and he still pushes her away, even though they have some tender moments throughout the film. But and then at the end of the film, he's just like, woe is me, I'm going to go fight this battle, which ends in classic film way that he dies.
The gunfight at the OK Corral in this movie is depicted fantastically. I think it's an excellent action sequence.
It really is. And
it's very effective.
John Ford said that he had talked to Wyatt Earp, and this is like, that's how this is supposed to be thing. There's been some criticism of that statement, mostly from, I think, he was doing the interview with Bogdanovich.
Bogdanovich made a documentary about Ford,
and he Bogdanovich like confronts him with this. He's like, why is this not very historically accurate? He's like, and Ford of course reacts really not well. He's like, you're criticizing me? What? Did you like the film?
Yeah.
And it's like, well then, you know, if you like the film, why are you complaining? And I feel like that's a very Fordish thing to do. Fordy.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is I think probably the historical part of it that he was talking about was that it was not just them walking down, that it was kind of a military maneuver, like he had sent his guys around back to kind of outmaneuver them.
Yes.
From what I read, that may not be entirely historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, witnesses say that they were marching down in the middle of the town, much more like how you saw in 93's Tombstone with Val Kilmer. Anyway, I think that's what he was trying to get at. But it's beautifully well done gunfight.
Yeah. There's a great sequence where they're duking it out, Wyatt Earp and one of the Clantons, I think Billy Clanton, and a wagon crosses between them, and there's a huge dust cloud.
Cool dust, yeah.
And Clanton's just firing into the dust at random, and you hear the shots, and you see the muzzle flashes through the dust.
Yeah.
And Clanton just falls. Wyatt Earp got him.
And it kind of goes back, it is gritty. It is a kind of gritty gunfight.
It's very well done.
You know, if you like that sort of thing. My favorite part actually is Ward Bond jumping on top of the fence and like shooting Pa Clanton at the last moment.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Wyatt Earp gives him this kind of speech at the end where all of his boys are dead.
Yeah.
And he kind of says, I want you to live. I want you to know what my father is going to feel like yeah. when he hears that all his boys are dead.
And it brings it back to the beginning, that this is kind of a revenge for his younger brother.
So in a way, he has this kind of merciful attitude on this old man. And he's kind of the biblical idea of like piling. If you have mercy on your enemy, you'll pile coals on his head.
Kind of idea. I was gonna say it's not very merciful. He definitely wants this.
Yeah, he definitely wants to have revenge. Yeah. But he doesn't. He's not gonna make it quick.
Yeah, it's very slow.
He turns him loose, but Pa Clanton is unwilling to accept this. And tries to pull another gun and continue the fight. And in so doing,
there is a very
elicits
important...
the wrath of Ward Bond.
I love Ward Bond. There is a very important scene, I think, that we've kind of skipped over. It's a scene fairly early in the film. And from my understanding, this scene was not actually shot by Ford.
Mm-hmm.
The scene that Wyatt Earp, played by Henry Fonda, goes out to the gravesite of James Earp. And he kind of talks about how he's going to try to make this country or this town, you know, safe for young men like him.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that completely fits with the rest of the narrative, where it's kind of like this vengeance, I want to make you feel like my father's going to feel for you killing two of his boys.
Yeah.
But it definitely fits into what's going on in that time period.
Yeah.
Are we done with the summary? We did it. We made it through the summary.
Almost. We haven't done the ending.
The ending. Always the hardest part.
So, in conclusion, Doc Holliday is killed.
Yeah.
The only survivors, basically, are Morg and Wyatt.
Yeah.
And Morg is wounded, mm-hmm. I believe.
I don't remember.
Was arm in a sling?
Okay, yeah.
I think you might be right. Okay. And they're headed out of town to go
tell the news
to their parents. Family.
Yeah.
And he basically says he's going to get another herd of cattle and try again to make it as a cattleman.
Yeah.
And he says farewell to Clementine.
Yeah.
And this is a very interesting piece to me. Because it feels to me like the movie is about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie is called My Darling Clementine. So this whole love story between him and this Clementine, who's, to spring into Mythbusters mode for a moment, is not a real person.
It does not. She does not exist.
She was completely invented.
Yes.
It's kind of made to be very important in this last moments, and it's kind of an interesting story because he promises he's going to come back and see her, and she's going to stay in Tombstone and become a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sequence also not shot by Ford, they share a goodbye kiss, and then Wyatt Earp rides off into the sunset, so to speak.
As literal as you can get.
He rides off.
He definitely rides off.
And he's that's where the film leaves us. So there's no guarantees that they're going to get together or that they're going to be star-crossed lovers.
Very, very open-ended.
It's a very open-ended kind of love story and very, very subtly done. There's no promises, no guarantees, not much of anything to hang your hat on.
It just,
other than the looks in their faces.
It just ends. They're
talking to each other.
Yeah.
And that's what they give you. Now, the way that Ford originally shot it, there's multiple versions of this movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I knew there was another version. I didn't realize there was multiple.
Well, there's the version that Ford was responsible for cutting together. And then he showed it to Daryl Zanuck, the mm-hmm. head of Fox.
Yeah, I knew he had a big
influence. Zanuck and Ford worked together a lot. To great success, most notably on The Grapes of Wrath, mm-hmm. which is a film that Ford actually hadn't seen what Zanuck did. Zanuck edited The Grapes of Wrath.
Really?
And Zanuck talked him into it. He talked Ford into it and said, trust me, I can edit your movie. And that's the level of trust that they were at that time, which this would be 1940 would be?
Yeah, Grapes of Wrath. Grapes of Wrath is 40. Yeah.
So Zanuck is a very competent editor. People talk about studio executives as coming in and making these executive decisions, and they're seen as thwarting the artistic vision of directors.
Yeah.
But Zanuck and Ford actually had kind of a complementary relationship in times past.
Yeah.
Well, by this time, John Ford has gone off to war. He's moved on to a new phase of his life, and he's very interested in becoming more autonomous and having more control over his movies.
Yeah.
So Zanuck comes in and wants to make changes, and Ford is very resistant to it. So Ford had his initial cut. Zanuck had a long list of changes he wanted to make, and Ford basically washed his hands of the whole thing and said,
Yeah. I mean, from my understanding, he never really kind of took to this film after that anyway.
And offered him... He had the opportunity to do more work with Fox and with Zanuck, but he turned it down in order to work with his own production company in the future.
Yeah.
So,
this was his last film on his contract, right?
Yeah, this was his final film for Fox on his contracted requirements. So, Zanuck came in and made several changes. They did some test screenings and made more changes. The only versions that have survived are the final that we know of. Are the final theatrical, which is the version most people have seen, and the version that we watched.
We watched it, yeah.
And then there's a early screener version that Zanuck had already made changes and done some reshoots and some re-edits. That's slightly longer. I think it's maybe 6 minutes longer, okay, or shorter. It's not a significant,
yeah,
not a massive change. And then some people from the, I want to say the Los Angeles Film Preservation Society, recreated some scenes that were thought to be missing. So there's some of those on the Criterion release. If you're able to get your hands on that, if you want to see some of the missing links.
That is recommended.
Yes, I definitely recommend the Criterion version if you can get your hands on it. Because it's, sometimes the Criterion versions are not worth the extra money. This is one that is.
That definitely is.
It has a lot of bonus content on it, and it's very, very fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And some audio commentaries from a prominent Ford scholar. So all that kind of, all those kind of goodies if you're interested in that. If you want to know more about Ford and Zanuck and their relationship. And
I do want to take a moment and insert this in here, is that the reason we keep saying we don't want to be Mythbusters mode here, this is probably the first film, actual whole film, that is based off a historical event that we've been doing on this podcast.
Yes, it is. That's true.
We did Covered Wagon, which has Kit Carson in it, and he has this comedic role in that. Who is actually, he's a historical, no, not Kit Carson, it was Bridger.
Jim Bridger,
and he's a historical figure, but we really, this is the first full film that's based off a historical event and, yeah, historical figures. And when we're doing these episodes, I kind of feel like we're more talking about the decade that they've been made in, mm-hmm, and kind of that's the historical event that we want to talk about, not necessarily what these films are presenting in the,
yes,
in the West.
That's a good point.
But what they're talking about in the 20th century, what's happening and why these films were made.
Yeah.
So want to make that point, that why we're not going so deep into the Mythbuster and
which we could,
wider. And we could.
This is almost as historically inaccurate as something like Braveheart.
Or Gladiator.
Or Gladiator.
Yeah. So
we could talk for a long time about that.
Yeah. And I don't know. What is your opinion on historical accurateness of films? Because I know it was a push for a while to be like as accurate as we can be, especially in the 90s.
Yeah.
They were like, we got to make this accurate. What is your opinion on films? Does it have to be?
I think it definitely doesn't have to be. Well, for one thing, it definitely can't be.
Right.
Because when you're telling a story with film, you're literally compressing events into a short period of time.
Right.
So there has to be compression, and there are limits to what you can do within that compressed space, right, and time.
Yeah.
So you're almost required by the form to make changes if you're going to make a movie.
Yeah.
Now with television's interesting because these days you have a lot of control to do whatever you want.
Right. You can stretch that out.
So things like Chernobyl that HBO did are, yeah, very, very invested in historical accuracy,
and
they're able to do that because of the space they have.
And do a little.
If they were making a Chernobyl movie,
it would not be as accurate. And you know, a little shout out. You showed me a YouTube video about Chernobyl, the television show.
Yeah, if you go over to YouTube and look up Thomas Flight, his YouTube channel has a great video about Chernobyl, comparing side by side footage that they created for the show and documentary footage of the actual Chernobyl event itself. All that to say, I think it's good to have accuracy, but fiction, Neil Gaiman is one of my favorite writers, as you know.
He's awesome. I like him too.
He has a quote where he says something to the effect of, fiction is not the truth, but it rhymes with it. So there's a kind of an element where it has to be grounded in truth. It can't just be anything you want to say, unless you're doing a fantasy historical revisionist piece. But even then, there has to be some sort of grounding in the truth, because people have built-in BS detectors, and they're going to know if you're trying to pull a fast one.
Yeah.
But one thing that One of my primary sources for this is a book called Print the Legend by Scott Amon.
Yeah.
A biography of John Ford, and he talks about this film in it. One of the things that he says in there is that Ford might not have got the events right, but a lot of people who lived through those times claimed that he captured the spirit of what men were like. And even in this review, we were talking about
the grittiness of it. And
yeah, and well, and also the spirit of the townsfolk.
Okay, yeah.
To build the town and
yeah,
the way the West was developing in those days, and with the Transcontinental Railroad and all those historical things that were kind of creating a more progressive.
That old debate of civilization versus frontier.
Yeah, that kind of juxtaposition and the mild-manneredness of Earp and these kind of things that...
The wildness of Paul Clanton.
Right.
Yeah.
These kind of things are things that are true to the spirit, if not the...
The letter.
If not the letter of what happened in the Wild West.
Yeah.
So I think it's more important to stick to the spirit than the letter in terms of dealing with fiction.
Yeah.
That's a very long-winded answer, but...
Yeah, you'll just edit it out.
delete.
Just cut it down and post.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is apropos for this film.
Yeah.
So, let me give you a rundown. This is our 1940s film. So, what's happening in the 40s, and I'm going to talk mostly of the 40s, what's happening in 46. But FDR starts the decade off as president.
Mm-hmm.
He actually dies in 1945 after four terms. Not for complete terms, but he does win the office four times, which is completely unheard of.
How far into his fourth term was he?
I have my note here that he dies after 13 years in office, so I guess only about a year.
Gotcha.
And then Harry S. Truman, who is actually his third VP, takes over at that point.
Gotcha.
Out of the four terms.
Now, Truman, wasn't Truman from the other side of the aisle?
No.
Weren't they kind of...
No, actually, he was very much a hardcore New Dealer.
He was a hardcore New Dealer.
Yeah, they're both from the Democratic Party, which that means kind of different things.
Did they run against each other at some point within the party?
That I don't remember.
Okay, maybe what I'm thinking of.
But I don't think he ever challenged him for president.
Gotcha.
That would have been something probably frowned upon about the Democrats. Yeah, even the Republicans were like, can we really beat this guy? There was a few that came close, I'm thinking of Republican Mr. Dewey. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and Dewey will run against Truman. In fact, there's the famous photograph of Harry S. Truman holding up a newspaper saying, Dewey wins. And actually, Truman had won the election at that point.
Yeah.
And he does win his second term in 1948. So he'll finish the decade off as president.
Yeah.
Also going on in the 1940s, obviously, World War II. This is... it actually is taking place before our last film, so early on in 39, with Europe powers, the United States comes in late 41,
mm-hmm.
December 41, and they will finish it out, and the war ends in Europe in May of 45,
yeah.
Then Japan August of 45.
This is very much a, not just a decade defining conflict, but century defining.
It's, yeah. Even today, things that were settled out of World War II are still pushing the dominoes, sort of speak. No, not a reference to the Truman Doctrine. Anyway, but you can still see the effects today of World War II.
Yeah.
And some say that those effects are winding down, and we're kind of like looking at a much more of a new era as far as foreign affairs goes. But yeah, you can still see World War II.
I mean, the ways that boundaries are drawn in Europe.
Yeah.
A lot of those things
those
were determined
are,
in those
years.
Are
changing.
Right.
There's been several new countries. Obviously, Yugoslavia is no longer in existence. But anyway, the war takes place from in the 40s, obviously from 40 to 45. Everything from Dunkirk, Pearl Harbor, D-Day, and then, of course, the bombings of Hiroshima. And this enters the atomic age. So atomic energy is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this movie is released in December of 1946. So you can kind of do the math there. It's about a year and a half after the war ends.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still see the echoes from the war with that whole speech that I'm guessing Zanuck put in with at the gravesite.
Yes.
Right. He's talking about we're gonna make this a better town or a better world. And that's kind of the same, that's kind of the rhetoric you're seeing coming out of Hollywood for the war years. Mm-hmm. We're in this war for a good reason. So you kind of see some of those echoes even coming out of there. A lot of GIs are coming home because they were like, Truman, you got to bring the boys home. And he does that. He pares down the army tremendously. So they're coming home. It's the beginning of the baby boom.
Yes.
Yes. So a lot of people getting married. A lot of people getting divorced, a lot of people having babies. So here,
I feel like that's inextricably linked with the Western.
It is
a lot of ways because the Western as a genre is almost kind of a pre baby boom genre.
And then after it, you definitely see that change.
Yeah, the baby boomers reinvent the Western.
Yeah,
when they come of age in the 1960s.
Very much so. Yeah,
and. There's very much a sense of after World War II, and well, even in World War I, they talked about the war to end all wars.
Mm-hmm.
But with the introduction of the atom bomb,
yeah,
it became world wars and conflict in general, war in general,
there was
become a much more serious business.
There was actually a lot of optimism that the threat of atomic war and the new electronic computers and the UN, because the UN just comes out of here, pops out of here. This actually, I think, this year in 1946.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of hope that this is actually going to end wars here.
Mm-hmm.
To end all wars was thought to be World War I.
Yes.
But they actually thought that we have a chance now with World War II.
Right. Yeah.
Because
of how horrible the technology had become and.
Yeah.
The ability to annihilate each other. So I think there is in this film a kind of echo of that acknowledgement of the terribleness of
war and violence.
But there's also a kind of, with a lot of Westerns, almost all Westerns, have a kind of sense of fading nostalgia for a time, an American time gone by.
I didn't catch that a lot with this film.
You don't feel that as much?
I don't feel a whole lot of nostalgia. Maybe a little bit with Paul Clanton.
Nostalgia might be the wrong word, but a kind of like a yearning for a simpler time.
I feel there's a lot more an attempt to make this town more civilized, and that I think I got that message more than I got.
You felt the progressivism stronger than the the aching.
I felt that much more. Maybe you kind of see both in here, I guess, because of the debate between Clanton and Earp.
Yeah,
but I feel a lot more that the Earp's winning kind of shows like there's a new light. We've gone through the midnight, and now we're going to find the new dawn.
I think there is both, but I do see in some of John Ford's direction and some of Henry Fonda's performance too, a kind of wistful looking back to the time of the West and a romanticism of it.
Very much, there is romanticism. I definitely. See that, there's a romantic, there is a definitely romanticism, maybe not
I finally picked the right word.
Romanticism is definitely the word, and that's just Ford. I think that's Fordian in its purest sense. Going back here, let me just run through this real quick.
Mm-hmm.
1946, the federal minimum wage was 40 cents, the average annual income was $2,600. And the a house was $5,150, so the average house price. Wow. Monthly rent, $35 a month. A new car was $1,125. First class U.S. postal stamp was 3 cents. 1 year of tuition at Harvard. You want to give it a guess?
No.
$420 was a 1 year tuition.
Oh, it makes me sick.
Movie ticket was 55 cents.
Wow.
A gallon of gasoline, 21 cents. A gallon of milk, 67 cents. A dozen eggs, 59 cents. And a loaf of white bread was 10 cents. Now, these, I'm going to also tell you my source here. This was the www.afcea.org. And I will tell you that it's been a little while since I looked that up. So I'm not sure what they were advertising, but I feel like it was a company that they were trying to show you 46 versus 2006, which was the article.
Gotcha.
So that was where I got that. Some big events happening. ENIAC was the first electronic computer.
Yeah.
So we've hit the computer age at this point. The UN General Assembly meets for the first time in London.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the UN coming up out of this, out of the... Franklin Roosevelt appears on the dime for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
This is all happening in 46. There's the famous Iron Curtain speech by Winston Churchill. So this is starting off the Cold War. And we have to talk about the Cold War because we're going to talk about the Cold War a lot in the coming in the next coming months.
So much for your optimism.
No kidding.
Mom and Dad.
On race relations, there is a riot in Columbia, Tennessee, where two were killed. But also, Kenny Washington is the first African-American to sign for an NFL team since 1933.
Still very much in the thick of the Jim Crow era.
Very much so. There's very much that segregation going on here. Television becomes a huge thing. So first hour-long entertainment TV show, NBC's Hourglass, premieres. A great movie, Big Sleep, directed by Howard Hawks, which we're going to talk about in the next episode, premieres. Let's see. Christmas classic It's a Wonderful Life, It's actually on the AFC or AFI 100.
Yes.
Great
top movie. Also starring Ward Bond.
Yes, he was also in it.
So Ward Bond.
That's a great story. You should tell the story.
Ward Bond is working on John Ford's on both films, and they're kind of shooting back to back, and Ford and Capra are going back and forth talking about how they're going to share this actor. they rearrange their shooting schedules to accommodate, but Ford sends a letter to Capra, basically in jest, I think it's fair to say.
I think it's very much fair to say.
Saying that everybody's especially anxious to get Ward Bond over to the Capra set, and Henry Fonda will even throw in an antique Victrola. And half of his salary, or something to that effect.
Yeah,
to get Ward Bond to go to the other set. So
anyway, both films are going on basically at the same time. The U.S. drops the first atom bomb on Bikini Atoll. So this is the fourth atomic explosion in the world. And this is atomic energy. They're testing it, and so this is also kind of one of those optimistic things that atomic energy is going to change the world. And of course, we were just talking about Chernobyl,
mm-hmm.
And that happens a couple of decades later, I believe, in the
60s. In the 80s,
I think. Is it the 80s? Okay. But also, notice it was the Bikini Atoll. Something else was unveiled during this year.
Mm-hmm.
That was the actual bikini swimsuit.
Yes. Very controversial.
Very controversial. Actually, I saw a picture of the original bikini, and it's actually surprisingly... I say modern. I think modern may be the term. Apparently, the person who coined the phrase bikini said it couldn't be a real bikini unless you could fit the entire swimsuit through a wedding ring, which was a joke because you're married. He also apparently said that he wanted to name bikini in honor of the Bikini Atoll, which was atomically bombed. Yes. Yeah, so it was an atomic
reality. Talk about a bombshell.
That's the joke.
therein lies the joke.
Therein lies the joke. But anyway, big impact on pop culture and culture at large.
Yes. I've been told, this might be an apocryphal story, that when they started becoming popular and they were all the rage, the bikinis, certain beaches were requiring one-piece swimsuits.
Uh-huh.
And they complied by removing the tops.
I don't know about that story. Moving on, U.S. President Harry Truman establishes the AEC, which is the Atomic Energy Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that kind of that progress thought. Foghorn Leghorn is established, however you want to say it, but he has debuted.
He's unleashed.
He has debuted on his Merry Melodies. I think that's probably all I have here.
Gotcha.
If you're a Tintin fan, that was first edition was published in 46.
In English or
in French?
The original French.
By Hergé. Hergé? Is that how you say his name?
Hergé?
I don't know. But yeah.
I do love those comics.
1946, a great year.
Yes, indeed.
To summarize, I guess.
Any other stories we want to tell about the film? Anything else?
I definitely want you to tell the Walter Brennan story before.
Yeah, that's a very short story. Walter Brennan is struggling with his horse. This is the only time Brennan and Ford, two legends of the Western genre, were together. and Ford is a notorious director. He's one of the directors that made famous the stereotype that directors are very demanding, dictatorial, abrasive figures.
That's not John Ford.
John Ford very much liked to rule with an iron fist. And he was kind of from what I've been able to uncover about him, obviously he's a complex figure. But from what I've been able to uncover about him, he liked to bait people, and he liked to put pressure. He liked to push people.
Which may be why he didn't get along with Kathy Downs or Linda Darnell.
Or Linda Darnell.
Yeah.
So he likes to push hard, and some people would rise to the challenge. Some people just found it to be too much. So he goes out to make. They built this the set for this movie, this town of Tombstone, in the middle of the wilderness. Basically, it's very remote, and they have a remote campsite, which is something he does for a lot of his films. Actually, he goes off in the desert and shoots these movies isolated from anybody. So he kind of has complete control over his campsite. And Brennan, who's at this point an established actor. Comes in to be part of this world, and he's having trouble with his horse, and Ford says, "Can't you ride a horse?" And Brennan responds with, "No, but actually I won 3 Oscars for acting."
I think there's some choice words in there too.
That's the censored version.
I
cleaned it up for the radio.
But apparently they didn't get along at all.
No.
Like, this harsh old man that you see in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Walter Brennan was really acting there. He is pretty mean.
You can tell he's a little bit grumpy.
Yeah.
Some of that bleeds through into the performance, I think.
Just a little.
But I think, some of that is from Ford's direction, too. Where he would push people. And out of that comes some great performances.
Yeah.
But there's also kind of a good old boy club, a boys club kind of feeling to it.
A lot. If you look at a lot of Ford's films, you will see the same character actors again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Carey was one of his favorite actors. Harry Carey is awesome, by the way. I was watching Sea of Grass the other night on DCM, and Harry Carey's in that. And then when Harry Carey passed away, he had his son, Harry Carey Jr., on just a lot of sets of films that he did. Yeah.
So very much, very kind of old world in that way. A lot of loyalty.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know, corruption is not the right word.
Nepotism.
Nepotism is good.
Yeah. And that's the thing. If you betrayed his trust, he was also very vindictive.
He was the sort of person who would hold a grudge.
Yeah.
He was a strong drinker, had a lot of affairs, but remained married to the same woman for pretty much his entire life.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable. So he definitely separated his family life and his work life.
Yeah.
Very Irish. Irish, John Ford. Yeah. One generation removed.
You know where he's born, right?
Boston? New England?
He's born in Maine.
In Maine.
Yeah, he's in New England. And I think it was his dad and mom were from the old country.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can just kind of imagine those stories that he was told. And he's like, he's like 13th or 15th in a... in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's one of the younger guys. So,
is that our cue?
That is our cue.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to this Westerns by the Decade episode of the Pop Story and Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, follow us on social media, and we will talk to you next time.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Chris.
And thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Popstorian podcast. Be sure to subscribe. You can find us online at popstorian.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Tune in next time for more of the history of popular culture.